We were working in health, transportation, energy, and a lot of other smaller ones. Effectively, today, we're down to energy.
Federal funding cuts have diminished the influence of the Denali Commission. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an ACLU suit on behalf of a Matsu couple who want their records expunged.
The court did its job. The case was dismissed. They have no conviction, but the job's not done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Decreased federal spending has downsized the budget and scope of the Denali Commission in Alaska. The independent federal agency was created by former Senator Ted Stevens in 1998 to address infrastructure in rural communities. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, its financial clout is greatly diminished.
The Denali Commission has provided hundreds of millions of dollars for projects in Alaska villages over the last 14 years. There's been money for health clinics, power plants, and tank farms, but the flow of dollars is slowing down. The Commission's federal co-chair, Joel Niemeyer, has seen the agency's budget go from a peak of $150 million in 2005 down to $18 million this year.
We had many programs which we were working within. We're working in health, transportation, energy, and a lot of other smaller ones. Effectively, today, we're down to energy.
Niemeyer says the commission has gone from funding 10 large projects annually down to two or three a year now. Niemeyer was in Fairbanks Tuesday urging representatives of interior Alaska Native communities to work through regional organizations and agencies to better advocate for their share of Denali Commission grants. Niemeyer says coastal communities have used that strategy to get more money from the commission.
I've noticed there's a level of deference in the interior with the Athabascan community where they really place an emphasis on local decision making and they dare not cross that line. And so I've noticed working statewide that that respect for local decision making perhaps allows the other more aggressive regionals to bring the projects home.
Competition for funds is a growing issue as Denali Commission budgets decline. Niemeyer says the loss of congressional earmarks is a major hit to the commission. He says termed funding authorities that set up multi-year appropriations are considered earmarks and have not been renewed, eliminating a stream of dollars that supported the agency. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Japan is giving $6 million to the U.S. and Canadian governments to assist with the tsunami debris cleanup. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some in Washington, D.C. hope it will spur action from the federal government.
The money will be split between the five Pacific states and the government of British Columbia. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the money will go to the federal government, which will then dole it out to the states evenly. Senator Murkowski says she appreciates and welcomes Japan's measure of goodwill, and the amount of money is considerably more than the U.S. has given to its own states.
It's taken a year for the debris to show up on U.S. and Canadian shores. We kind of knew it was coming. We knew we were going to have to do something with it, and yet we really haven't seen the assistance come on from our government.
Earlier this year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration allocated $250,000 to the five Pacific states for cleanup efforts. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Alaska is one of only a handful of states that don't allow residents to expunge their records following an unlawful arrest. The ACLU is hoping to change that, filing suit against the state on behalf of a married couple in the Matsu who were arrested and charged for growing marijuana. A judge threw out the case because the search warrant request was mishandled. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
It's a complicated case, but a few years ago, troopers showed up at Robin Kling and Samantha Clymer's house in Willow. Kling's brother, Jeffrey LaPlante, had tipped troopers off that the couple was growing marijuana at their home. LaPlante was mentally ill and also accused Kling of assaulting him, a claim that was quickly proven false. In fact, LaPlante had been leaving threatening phone messages for Kling all day long. Jeffrey Mittman, executive director of the ACLU in Alaska, picks up the story from there.
So instead of doing what they should do and protecting the Clymers and Klings and their family, the cops say, we need to search your property for marijuana. Well, Robin and Samantha know the Constitution, they know the rights. They said, no, we really don't want you searching. So they request a search warrant.
But when the investigating officer asked a magistrate for a search warrant, he failed to mention that LaPlante was mentally ill and had been threatening Kling and Clymer. The search warrant was granted later that night, and troopers found 26 marijuana plants on their property and a third of a pound of processed marijuana. But a judge dismissed the case late last year. In the opinion, he wrote the investigator was more than negligent in his failure to disclose the additional information about the assault and LaPlante. Again, Jeffrey Mittman.
And the court lays out, step by step by step, all the misconduct of the police, why the Klings and Clymers should not have been prosecuted, should not have been arrested, why the state went awry. That's good. The court did its job. The case was dismissed. They have no conviction. But the job's not done.
The couple wants their property that was seized returned and their records expunged. Mittman says if that doesn't happen, the arrests will haunt them.
When they go for jobs with the state, the tourist industry, you'll see Robin Kling is an award-winning safety instructor for boating. The state won't hire him. They said, well, you've been arrested. You were prosecuted.
The couple isn't answering any questions about the case, citing the fact that it's ongoing litigation. But Samantha Clymer did make a brief statement.
If we don't take action, our friends in the Mat-Su and others all across Alaska would be vulnerable to government misconduct. We feel a responsibility to ensure that our founding documents were more than just words.
Clymer noted that she's a direct descendant of George Clymer, who is one of six people who signed both the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. The federal government in at least 45 states allow citizens to expunge their records following unlawful arrests. Josh Decker is trying the case for the ACLU. He says Alaska is one of the few states that's silent on the issue.
We have tried to work with the courts before, and they took the position that unless a judge specifically says, yes, the courts have this power, they are unable to go ahead and do it. So what we are asking in this litigation with Samantha and Robin today, we are asking the judges of Alaska to affirmatively say, this is a right that the courts inherently have, and we are going to exercise to protect individuals like Robin and like Samantha who have been victimized by police misconduct.
The ACLU was successful in getting the state to return a DNA sample they had taken from Robin Kling. Jeffrey Mittman says he's also hopeful the ACLU can work with the state to also have the couple's records expunged and their property returned without trying the case in court. The governor's office says it's not yet reviewed the lawsuit, and so it's too soon to comment on the issue. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
An Anchorage commercial property builder pleaded guilty today in U.S. District Court to 12 counts of making false statements to a credit union for more than $4 million in construction loan draws. Lee E. Baker Jr. was the owner of Discovery Construction Incorporated. In 2004, Baker was approved for a $9 million loan by Denali Alaska Credit Union to purchase property on Northern Lights and construct an 85-unit apartment building called Bryn Mawr. Assistant U.S. Attorney Retta Randall said, between September 2005 and January 2007, Baker submitted one-page construction loan draws itemizing work that he said had been completed.
Well, what Mr. Baker did on 12 different draws for over $4 million was falsify the amount of work that he claims to have completed and got the money, but did not use the money at least to complete the Bryn Mawr project because it never did get completed.
Randall says the documents Baker submitted are supposed to outline the progress of the construction.
And you list different amounts that you claim you have spent and what's been completed. And at the bottom, it's certified as a truthful statement. And so that statement is what makes the financial institution go ahead and disburse funds from the loan that's been approved.
Randall says the loan was defaulted and the Bryn Mawr property was sold. Baker will be sentenced by Judge Ralph Beislein on December 4th. He faces a maximum penalty of 30 years in prison, a fine of $1 million, or both. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitka takes on one of the most expensive projects in city history with grudging approval from the Assembly.
If I had my druthers, we'd delay a while, but apparently that's not really an option.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Project Management Institute will present 3 one-day seminars at the Petroleum Club of Anchorage, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Expert Neil Whitten will present No-Nonsense Advice for Successful Projects, Let's Talk, More No-Nonsense Advice for Project Success, and The Gift of Wisdom, Work-Life Balance for Today's Managers, Learn to Manage Projects, and more. Registration information at pmiak.org. This message sponsored by Project Management Institute, Alaska Chapter.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has given the go-ahead to the Alaska Railroad to construct a rail extension linking Houston to Port McKenzie. The Corps announced Monday that it has issued the wetlands permit under the Clean Water Act. Issuance of the permit allows the Matanuska-Susitna Borough to move forward with construction of the rail link. The borough wants the rail spur to enable South Central and Interior Natural Resource products to reach Tidewater shipping facilities at the port. The permit authorizes the Alaska Railroad to permanently fill more than 95 acres of wetlands to construct about 35 miles of new rail line. Matsu Borough Manager John Moosey.
We are very pleased. We have been working through this. We have a 550-page environmental assessment impact statement that allows us to construct this in an environmentally safe manner. We intend to do so. With this announcement, we're able to continue for segment one construction, and then also, too, we're prepared to issue another proposal out for bid so we can get segment three started, which is up toward the Houston area.
Moosey says the construction will take place in several segments. Preliminary work on segment one has already started, but continuation of the work dependent on approval of the wetlands permit.
We'll be able to have them continue with their project. Segment six, I think, is the next one we're starting on, which is up by Houston. So they do not go in order 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We have the segments, and they are constructed at different parts of the rail where we have the right-of-way and where we can have different contractors working at the same time.
If there are no delays, the spur project is expected to be completed in 2015. Environmental groups have filed suit against the Port McKenzie rail spur in federal court. That suit is pending. One year after an Alaska Railroad contractor began clearing land on the banks of the Tanana River at Salcha, the real work is about to begin on the state's longest bridge. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
While most projects are winding down just about now as the summer ends and winter nears, the work on the $188 million Tanana River Bridge is just about ready to kick into high gear. That's the sound of a massive hammer apparatus pounding away at steel pilings that project contractor Kiewit Pacific began driving into the Tanana Riverbed last week. Alaska Railroad Project Director Mark Peterbers says the pile driving marks the beginning of work on the base of the 3,300-foot bridge that will span the riverbed when the project is completed in 2014. Peterbers says Kiewit began driving smaller pilings in the spring for a temporary bridge called a causeway that enables workers and equipment to get into the middle of the riverbed to begin working on the piers for the main bridge structure.
We had some smaller ones as we built out with the temporary work, but this is a whole nother world now. This is a much bigger pile.
The pilings look like huge steel pipe, 3/4 inch thick, 6 feet in diameter, 43 feet long. They're hoisted into position by big cranes. There are 5 of them around the construction site. Peter Burrs says more than 300 sections of pilings have been trucked in from Valdez throughout the summer and are now stockpiled at the construction site on the banks of the Tanana, along with stacks of steel plate, rebar, earth movers, and numerous other pieces of equipment. The boneyard is part of a larger complex that includes a cluster of ATCO-like trailers where Peter Burrs and 100 others work. He says now that Kiewit has marshaled all that equipment and materials and nearly completed work on a 2-mile-long levee to divert the Tanana away from the Salcha side of the river, the contractor can now begin work on the main project.
This was the easy part, getting the levee built. Now getting out into the rivers is going to be the difficult part.
Peter Burrs says Kiewit will keep working until the holidays or until it gets too cold for an extended period. He says work will resume in February unless circumstances require modifying that schedule. In Salcha, I'm Tim Ellis.
Commercial fishing boats, tenders, and floating processors that operate more than 3 miles offshore will soon have to get safety exams every 2 years. Until now, those dockside exams were voluntary. Under the Coast Guard Authorization Act of 2010, they will be mandatory after October 16th, according to Ken Lorenson, the fishing vessel safety coordinator for the Coast Guard in Alaska.
Congress required the Coast Guard to write regulations to mandate dockside safety exams and that the vessel be issued a certificate of compliance when it has successfully completed that dockside exam for any and all commercial fishing vessels that is fishing or operating more than 3 miles from the territorial sea baseline.
Alaska's had much higher participation in the voluntary exam program than elsewhere in the country. However, Lawrenson thinks there are still many boats around the state that have not taken part and will need to do so by the time it becomes a requirement in mid-October.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The National Marine Fisheries Service has not followed through on its findings that two species of seal should be listed under the Endangered Species Act. The Center for Biological Diversity today asked the federal courts to order a specific date by which bearded and ringed seals will be listed. In documents filed with the courts this morning, the center says, quote, "This mandatory deadline is necessary to ensure the continued survival of ringed and bearded seals in the wild." The center originally petitioned the listing in 2008. After several delays, NIMS published its own findings that agreed with the petition and proposed the listing. Rebecca Noblin, the Alaska director for the center, says that publication in December of 2010 set a 1-year deadline for completion of the listing.
In December of 2011, they issued a public notice saying they were going to take 6 more months to consider, to just sort of, you know, make sure their science was right and have more peer review. And so that would have put them out to June of 2012. And since then, we haven't heard any word for why the delay is.
The court papers say that the lack of the endangered listing will result in irreparable harm to both species.
You know, climate change is really, really altering the Arctic quickly. As we've seen, this is the lowest sea ice year ever since we've been recording sea ice. And sea ice is absolutely essential for these seals. So it's certainly the time to act is now. And NIMS has said that it's planning to act. And under the Endangered Species Act, it's required to go ahead and finalize the listing decision so that we can start getting some protections in place.
Julie Spiegel with the National Marine Fisheries Service says work on the listing is ongoing, but she is not allowed to comment on litigation. Sitka's Blue Lake Dam expansion will move forward to provide more electricity to the community. The Assembly yesterday unanimously awarded a $92 million contract to Montana-based Barnard Construction. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Tuesday night might have been proof that among members of the Sitka Assembly, being unanimous and being enthusiastic are not the same thing. Here's Tor Christensen.
If I had my druthers, we'd delay a while, but apparently that's not really an option.
And Bill Payden.
We can't cancel it. It's not an option, in my opinion.
And Mim McConnell on the phone.
It's a risky thing and kind of a scary thing, and life can be uncertain like that.
And Pete Esquiro.
We've got a heck of a lot of work to do.
And Mike Reif.
The alternatives, there are none.
Still, it was 7 yes votes for one of the most expensive projects in city history, a boost to the Blue Lake Dam by about 80 feet, increasing the amount of electricity Sitka can generate from hydropower. The project's cost leapt by about $40 million, and the change will mean higher rates for Sitkans. Here's Reif talking with Utility Director Chris Bruton.
The rates are going to be somewhere around 15 cents a kilowatt in the year 2017. And when this project originally cost roughly $100 million, they're going to be roughly 2 cents lower than that.
Correct.
And so this is going to cost us this extra $40 million, this huge cost overrun this project. It's going to cost the average consumer in Sitka $300 a year, the average resident.
There wasn't a whole lot of public testimony on the contract. Matt Hunter said he supported the Assembly moving forward, that it could pay for a dam or it could pay for extra diesel, but either way, it was going to cost money. And one person spoke out against the project.
As I'm accustomed to doing, I'm probably going to take the minority opinion.
Former Mayor Marco Dapsevich.
Sometimes a good idea can turn into a bad idea. And I think that's where we're going. And I think really, if you look at where the utility rates are going in this town, I think you're going to find that the demand that you're hoping from that dam is not going to be there. There'll be less utility accounts, less people, less business, less a lot of things.
But Assemblymember Phyllis Hackett said the need to expand Blue Lake is urgent, and despite the higher-than-expected cost of the project, it must move forward. The Assembly, she said, is not taking the decision lightly.
I've been up here for 4 years now, which is not a long time, but I've been up here for 4 years, and we have asked the community once a month for 4 years to conserve, 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 and we're not getting it. So we have to provide energy. We have to do that. And the only other option is oil.
Canceling the project would mean more diesel use in the future and would be twice as expensive as expanding the dam, at least in the long run. That's according to a report prepared by consultants and city staff. Plus, said Mayor Cheryl Westover.
One thing that wasn't mentioned much in last night's work session was the carbon footprint that we would be laying down if we had to go to a lot of diesel burning.
Rebidding the contracts also won't work, the report said, because costs are only going to go up. Asking for bids again would put the project off a year and probably not fetch a lower price. Tuesday night's vote locked in the price and awarded the contract, but nobody's getting their shovel ready quite yet. In the world of big municipal projects, there's a difference between getting the job and starting the job. The Assembly still needs to approve something called a notice to proceed. It's the way a municipal government shouts go. At least one Assembly member, Christensen, said he's not promising he will. He says he'll need to see real work done on lowering the cost of the project before he votes yes. That was the other part of Tuesday night's conversation about the dam, and it took place behind closed doors. The Assembly wanted to talk about how to negotiate with the contractor, Barnard. Alaska law allows closed sessions to talk about legal matters and issues that, if made public, would hurt the city's finances. So the Assembly went into executive session with the municipal attorney and the panel of consultants and city staff who worked on the Blue Lake bids.
If you weren't part of the names listed in being invited in, then we invite you to come back after we've finished up our executive session.
When the door opened, an hour and a half later, engineering consultant Paul Carson said the city will ask Barnard to sit down with staff in the next 2 weeks and figure out ways to save money on the project. The goal is to have that done just after Alaska Day in mid-October, and then the Assembly would likely vote on the notice to proceed at its October 23rd meeting. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
As the 2012 visitor season nears an end, cruise lines large and small have been making their last trips of the year through Southeast Alaska. Lynn Blad Expedition's vessel National Geographic Sea Lion recently made one more stop in Petersburg, where KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein chatted with passengers on the docks about their trips.
Well, trip's been fantastic. I'm American. I live in The Hague in the Netherlands, however, for some years. We were in Denali National Park for 5 days before we came to the ship. That was also National Geographic Lindblad organization. It's just been spectacular. First time in Alaska for both of us.
How long have you been in Petersburg today, just for a little short visit?
We just
visit?
Got off the ship this morning at 8 o'clock. We're just going into town for a little bit of a look between things, and at 10:30 we're on a flight seeing trip over the glacier.
Have you had a favorite part of the trip so far?
All of it.
Great. Let's see, I'm from the Seattle area, the Olympic Peninsula, and we flew into Fairbanks about 3 weeks ago. We visited Denali, and we picked up the ship in Sitka, and we're traveling back to Seattle. It's a great trip.
Terry and Jim Teary were from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and just got off the Lindblad National Geographic Sea Lion this morning and touring around Petersburg, beautiful small town. Very reminiscent of some of the towns along the coast of Maine. We're from New Hampshire originally, so beautiful, except we don't have the mountains, of course, or the glaciers. Anyway, it's a spectacular day. Lovely trip.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Reddy. I'm from Plymouth, Massachusetts. And so far we've seen most of the glaciers and seen a lot of wildlife and enjoyed our boat ride.
And would you come back to Alaska if you had the opportunity?
Oh, absolutely. This is our second time here. We were here 5 years ago and loved it so much we wanted to come back and see more.
My name is Sue Lynn, and I'm from Harwichport, Massachusetts. Just happens that we live very close to each other. We didn't know each other before this trip. Alaska is a place I've always wanted to go. I feel like when I got off the plane at Anchorage, I was finally where the real world lived. It's like, this is it. This is life. This is the world. It's not that place back where we live, although Cape Cod is a gorgeous place and has many wildlife refuges, a lot of wildlife as well. But yes, would I come back on a heartbeat?
Those were some of the last cruise ship passengers of the year to stop in Petersburg. They spoke with KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety. Operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Ensuring our youth understand the need for workplace safety will help prevent injuries. If your middle or high school is interested in having a youth representative speak to your students about workplace safety, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Youth Safety at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.